this is going to be catastrophic. It will be, unless there are major moves to just cut San Quentin's population in half.
I recall lining up a photograph, and then I recall pain and wetness. I registered a dull thud, and I realized that I had been hit in the face.
Many citizens of the United States do not understand the relationship between the dollar as a currency of world trade, the dominance of Wall Street and the technological companies, and the U.S. military.
It's not to say that black men haven't been lynched, but I think we also need to recognize that black women have also been lynched, and black women have been subjected to atrocities that aren't documented in the same way as the murder of black men.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates. I'm Scott Baba. In today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, KPFA's Upfront covers the explosion of coronavirus cases at San Quentin Prison. Linda Tirado, a journalist who was maimed by police while covering the George Floyd protests, speaks before Congress. Horace Campbell discusses some of the economic factors contributing to the power of the ongoing protests. And Davey D. explores issues of the LGBTQ community and the Black Lives Matter movement. But first, the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Hong Kong police made their first arrest today under a new national security law imposed a day earlier by China's central government as thousands of people defied tear gas and pepper pellets to protest against it. Police said 9 people were arrested under the law, including a man with a Hong Kong independence flag and a woman holding a sign displaying the British flag and calling for Hong Kong's independence. Hong Kong police said on Facebook that they arrested more than 300 people on various charges, including unlawful assembly, possession of weapons, and violating the national security law. The arrests come as thousands took to the streets on Wednesday on the 23rd anniversary of Britain's handover of Hong Kong to China in 1997. For the first time, police banned this year's annual march. The new security law deepened concerns in Hong Kong and abroad about the semi-autonomous territory's future. China imposed the law following anti-government protests in Hong Kong last year. It makes what the state considers secessionist, subversive, or terrorist activities illegal, as well as foreign intervention in the city's internal affairs. Under the law, any person taking part in secessionist activities, such as shouting slogans or holding up banners and flags or calling for the city's independence, would be in violation of the law regardless of whether violence is used. President Trump is dismissing as fake news allegations that Russia offered bounties for killing U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Trump tweeted today that the allegations were made up to damage him and the Republican Party. Democrats have accused Trump of bowing to Russian President Vladimir Putin. House Democrats, returning from their own briefing at the White House, said they learned nothing new about assessments that suggested Russia was making overtures to militants as the U.S. and the Taliban held talks to end the war in Afghanistan. Republicans largely defended the president, arguing along with the White House that the intelligence was unverified. Russia's vote on constitutional amendments that could allow President Vladimir Putin to extend his rule until 2036 entered its final day today amid widespread reports of pressure on voters and other irregularities. Feature Story News' Lucy Taylor reports from Moscow.
Eager for a good turnout, election authorities have offered prizes to voters, ranging from cash to cars. The vote is a single yes or no question to give national approval to a package of hundreds of constitutional changes. Vladimir Putin urged Russians to think about their children and grandchildren, but opposition leaders say the poll is designed to distract attention from what they call a power grab. If the amendments are approved as expected, Vladimir Putin will be allowed to reset his presidential term limits and stand again for 2 extra terms in office. Lucy Taylor in Moscow.
Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves signed a bill Tuesday to retire the state's flag, which features the Confederate battle emblem. It's a symbol that's widely condemned as racist. Reeves said the 126-year-old banner has been a source of division in the state for too long.
A flag is a symbol of our present, of our people, and of our future. For those reasons, we need a new symbol.
Mississippi has faced increasing pressure to change its flag since protests against racial injustice have focused attention on Confederate symbols in recent weeks. New York City lawmakers today approved a plan to shift $1 billion from policing to education and social services in the coming year. The spending plan, passed by the City Council, came as lawmakers struggled to deal with the fallout of the coronavirus pandemic, which has sapped the city of billions of dollars in revenue. Mayor Bill de Blasio told CNN he supports the move.
We found a way to keep our patrol strength consistent and keep people safe while saving a lot of money, reducing overtime costs, figuring out things that the NYPD should not do anymore that could be better done by civilians.
The move is in reaction to protests in recent weeks calling for spending for some police departments to be redirected to housing, mental health, and other services.
Welcome to COVID, Race, and Democracy. First up, Brian Edwards-Tiekert and Kat Brooks co-host KPFA's Up Front. They spoke with Megan Cassidy, a crime reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, who's been covering the COVID-19 outbreak that has exploded at San Quentin Prison, where over 1,100 inmates have been confirmed infected. Cassidy spoke about how the outbreak started there and the conditions that have contributed to worsening the situation.
Megan Cassidy, why don't you walk us through what we know about how this started?
Sure. So late in May, we know that there was a major outbreak going on in Chino at the California Institution for Men. It was by far the deadliest outbreak, as well as the largest. Still, even to this day, no other prison comes close to the number of deadly cases that it has had. There are right now 16 deaths that came from CIM, whereas every other prison either has one, three, or zero. So it's one of those, the roads to hell are paved with good intentions. I think that there was a big rush to try to get some of the more medically vulnerable men out of there, the older, the people with underlying health conditions, and move them to places where there are not any cases. But where the missteps came is this, it just happened way too quickly. We have been told that the men who were slated for transfer had been tested prior to transfer. That was, I mean, it was very misleading, if not false. The men there, we know from some internal emails and from and just multiple interviews with people who are not able to go on the record, that they were not tested for 2-3 weeks and sometimes even up to a month before they were placed on buses by the dozens, about 2 dozen per bus, and then transferred to either Corcoran or San Quentin. Corcoran got 66 people, and then San Quentin got 121. And as soon as these men got off the bus, a handful at each facility tested positive.
Where are the places that the officials at San Quentin could have or should have intervened?
I mean, I think that you could argue just from the beginning, San Quentin is already an overcrowded prison, but that's like everyone, but they have dorms. They have already an older population there. There are a lot of lifers there. Obviously, death row is there too. But kind of the problem with San Quentin and really every other prison is that the prisons are so overpopulated that it's almost impossible to have social distancing. If you wanted to do anything substantial, you would have to release about 20,000 people just to get at 100% capacity.
I also understand that when the people that were incarcerated at Chino were transferred to San Quentin, that they were literally stacked, you know, they were on top of, on the floors, on top of people that had already been there with not solid doors, but open, you know, open air cells.
Right. And that was another point where I believe that CDCR was being very misleading, saying that they were not going to intermingle these people with the they call the native San Quentin population. So the newly transferred guys were put into a unit called Badger, and they were put on the higher tiers there. And they have these permeable cells where the vapors, droplets are able to intermingle and then fall on the lower tiers, which is what is believed to have started this spread, not just among the people that were placed on the buses from CIM, but what started it at San Quentin.
So what is happening at San Quentin is a disaster, but can you talk about the potential implications for the larger Bay Area with an outbreak this size, specifically with so many people who work there who are moving in and out of the prison into our communities?
Sure. And not just that, but it has a large potential of overwhelming hospitals, too. And that's something that the memo from researchers said now, I believe it was over 2 weeks ago, that this is going to be catastrophic. It will be, unless there are major moves, the researchers said, to just cut San Quentin's population in half. If we don't do that, this is going to be catastrophic at the prisons, and it's going to overwhelm the community hospitals here. And we've already started to get word over the weekend that some of the nurses at the local hospitals are seeing this. We know that last week that there were 16 men who already had to leave San Quentin to go to outside hospitals, and that was midweek last week. I don't even know what it's at now.
I mean, and I think it's important to point out part of the reason for that, is the medical treatment that one gets inside of a prison is mediocre at best. But secondarily, a lot of people that have been incarcerated for any particular amount of time have the underlying conditions, a lot of the underlying conditions that are going to make the symptoms of COVID-19 much more serious and potentially fatal for them.
Exactly. Another thing to note, too, is that I'm not sure how much room there even is now to spread people around. But in the beginning, a lot of people didn't even want to be tested, and they're not forced to be tested, but because they were in fear that they would be put into the hole, ADSEG. So if you test positive, then you are essentially punished for it. Your personal belongings are taken away. What few rights you have, like to visit the canteen, to make a call out, that's taken away because of the quarantine or the isolation that they put you in. And so it's very, very possible that the outbreak is even worse than what we see on the tracker right now.
What, if anything, is San Quentin saying about decarceration, about not thinking about transferring folks from one prison to another and repeating this fiasco, but doing what public health officials and other experts are saying, which is just letting people out?
Very, very little. That has just been the elephant in the room. Governor Newsom has the power to do this. He has said very little about the situation. If anything, it's always we're looking at this, we're keeping an eye on it. As far as doing the types of widespread releases that health officials, the advocates are calling for, there's been radio silence from the part of CDCR and the administration.
That was Megan Cassidy, crime reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, speaking with Upfront's Brian Edwards-Tiekert and Kat Brooks. The Upfront host also spoke to Ben Trefney, news director at KALW Public Radio in San Francisco, and the head of the Northern California chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, or the SPJ. They spoke about SPJ members at San Quentin, incarcerated men who've become journalists who report from inside the prison, and they discussed the challenges facing those individuals.
Among the people incarcerated in San Quentin, a few dozen incarcerated journalists. They are members of the first satellite professional journalism association in a prison in the country. They have worked on producing stories, podcasts, including Ear Hustle, a show that we are here on KPFA. And the local chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists has started to weigh in with the governor to try to speak up for their safety and their ability to get their stories out from inside the prison. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
It's strange times, man. How are you is a very fraught question these days.
Can
you tell us
all morning about that.
A little bit about your chapter members in San Quentin and what they do?
Sure. There's about three dozen SPJ members who are incarcerated at San Quentin. And so a lot of them have been working for a very long time on media such as San Quentin News, which is a very old and respected newspaper. There's also the First Watch Video Project, which you can see videos on YouTube, and they talk about life inside prison. And also Adnan Khan, who is the founder of First Watch. He works with Restore Justice in the East Bay, which is a prison advocacy organization. As you mentioned, Ear Hustle, and also there's another podcast called Uncuffed that we actually produce out of KALW. So there's a really robust media center there. And once a week, journalists come in from around the Bay Area, people who work in TV and radio, in print, online, and they teach journalism to inmates who are there. And right now there's about three dozen active members of the satellite chapter at San Quentin.
What have you been able to get out from them since the outbreak started a little less than a month ago in San Quentin?
Almost nothing, because we work with the men inside the media center, which is part of the education wing of San Quentin State Prison. They usually communicate with us through there. We have one of the employees of San Quentin who facilitates phone calls, but because they are essentially on a lockdown in their cells or with very limited mobility around the prison in order to take care of their regular functions and eat and shower and so forth, we have not been able to connect with pretty much anybody. We've gotten scattered reports here and there, but essentially communication has been extremely limited with incarcerated people.
This is a time when they are journalists living at the center of one of the biggest public health stories in the state right now, which is the outbreak in San Quentin. What are you asking the governor to do about it?
Well, this is an overcrowded prison to begin with. I think that its capacity is supposed to be not a lot more than 3,000, but it's actually operating at about 4,000 people right now. And I think that that number of 1,000 people who have contracted COVID-19 or so far have been diagnosed with that, I like to contextualize that by saying that's about a quarter of the population. So about a quarter of an entire population of a facility has COVID-19 right now. And that facility has, you know, an extra 1,000 people that it should not have in there right now.
Were you worried in the chapter that writing a public letter standing up for the people you work with in San Quentin would hurt your ability to get access to the prison to work with them in the future?
That's a pretty interesting question. I mean, as journalists, I think that we always weigh the value of activism and the impact of it. We want to make sure that we could be trusted by the community to report fairly. But I think that in this case, because there are about three dozen of our colleagues who we work with closely, I mean, I've worked with people inside of San Quentin for about 8 years now. Through training programs we operate at KALW, it's kind of a different role. Like I said, they're our colleagues. They're not just subjects upon whom we're reporting. They're people who we know pretty well. And so to advocate for them, knowing from an inside perspective, as reporters do also, what the situations are like in there, which it was just our duty, I think, to call upon the state to take more action. And you know, I think that there's a lot of blame that's going around about why this happened, and I imagine that you've talked about that. But what we want is just action to protect the lives of both our colleagues and then the rest of the people who are within the prison system. And that does not seem like too much to ask.
All right. Ben Trefney, thank you for the work. Appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about it on our radio station. Thanks very much.
Likewise. Thanks. Good to talk with you.
Ben Trefney is chair of the local chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists of Northern California, counts more than 30 men in San Quentin among its members. He's also news director at KALW Public Radio in San Francisco, our friend across the bay. San Quentin's a place I've taught a couple of workshops over the years to men working on journalism projects inside. And, you know, in decades of working with people as a trainer, as a mentor, and a teacher, I think it's where I've enjoyed it the most. It's horrible that it has to be in a prison, but the people there have made it a special place. And it's horrible to think of this virus tearing through it.
You know, we've covered San Quentin over the last 5 days, I guess, three different times, and every single time the numbers have skyrocketed. I mean, I think we've gone from 400 and something cases the first time we covered it late last week to over 1,000 today. That's horrifying and very scary in terms of what it means for people on the inside.
And also, like, stunningly unsurprising, at the very start of the outbreak, Kat, you were bringing people onto these airwaves who work with folks in the prison system, saying in a pandemic, this is like a pile of tinder waiting to go up in flames. You need to get people out. Public health officials from Berkeley have been writing to San Quentin specifically, saying if you don't draw down the prison population now, you're going to overwhelm not just the prison's medical facilities, but like the hospitals in the county and adjoining counties. And we saw some lip service from public officials, but to date, the state's only reduced its prison population by about 3% in response to this pandemic. And that's since March.
It's just such commentary on how people in power see certain members of our community as disposable. And, you know, those are majority black and brown bodies.
That was Brian Edwards Tickert and Kat Brooks speaking with Ben Trefney, head of the Northern California chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. Linda Tirado is a freelance journalist and photographer who was blinded in one eye when she was shot in the head with a rubber bullet by police while she was covering the George Floyd protests in Minneapolis. She spoke before the House Committee on Oversight and Reform during a briefing on state violence against civil rights protesters and journalists. There, she described the moment leading up to her injury and the actions of the police officers who shot her.
Today marks the one-month anniversary the last time I will have woken up with sight in both of my eyes. Tomorrow will be the one-month anniversary of the morning I woke up in a hospital and doctors informed me that I had been blinded in one eye. I had been in Minneapolis for fewer than 48 hours. My name is Linda Tirado, and I am a journalist. I'm a writer, a photographer, and a published author. I've covered civil unrest in America since 2014, and my work on this issue has taken me from Ferguson to Chicago, to Washington, D.C., to the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, and finally to Minneapolis. I'm here to bear witness to my own experience. I went to Minneapolis because I expected that George Floyd's death was going to be a catalyst for civil unrest. I arrived in Minneapolis on Thursday, May 28th, and I was out on the streets taking photos until 4 a.m. On Friday, May 29th, I went out again at about 8 p.m. It was the first night with a curfew, but press had been exempted from that so that we could do our jobs and cover the news. I was wearing my usual clothes for these situations, a t-shirt and a pair of shorts with a lot of pockets. I had a backpack and I wore my press credentials conspicuously on a lanyard around my neck. I always carry my reporter's notebook in the right side pocket of my cargo shorts and my recorder in the left. I was also holding my professional grade Nikon camera with a full flash. Protesters could tell immediately that I was working. They asked me more than once who I was working with. Protesters had no trouble identifying me as a journalist. As I've learned from covering other mass protests, these types of events have similar patterns no matter where you go. Police form ranks and push protesters back. Protesters retreat a few blocks. And then a certain detente settles in on both sides while everyone waits to see what will happen next. I arrived during one of those lulls and I took pictures of the police line because it is my job to try to explain to the public what is happening on their streets. On May 29th, when I heard from protesters that police were deploying tear gas nearby to where I was, I put on my goggles and my respirator and headed toward the 5th Precinct. I would like to share some of the photographs that I took that night. These photos show clearly what I saw. Here's one of my photographs showing the police during one of the moments I just described. They're holding their line. The photos that I'm going to show you now were among the last pictures I took with my camera on Friday night. I took these in the no man's land between police and protesters. And it's not uncommon for the press to exist in that space, particularly photographers. So this is the fifth from the last photograph I took. It shows an officer loading his gun from the bandolier on his vest. Ballistics experts will probably be able to tell from this photograph what sorts of rounds were being used by the police. I turn now to the third from the last photograph I took. The police are in riot gear and wearing vests that clearly say Minneapolis Police Department. Finally, here is the last photograph that I took before I was shot. You can see an officer pointing his gun directly down my camera lens. You can also see that at least one other officer is pointing their gun at me. You'll also notice in this photograph that a group of officers seem to be milling around on that street corner. This was not a particularly dangerous moment for them. This was a moment of pause. This group of officers were not part of the ranks who had been holding their line. One even seemed like he was using his phone. The photos do not show police that seemed concerned about my presence, nor do I recall feeling as though I were in any imminent danger. I felt confident in my position because I was readily identifiable as press and because I was not impeding the police. I recall lining up a photograph. And then I recall pain and wetness. I registered a dull thud and I realized that I had been hit in the face with something. My goggles came off and tear gas hit my eyes. I realized I was bleeding, so I squeezed my eyes shut and started instinctively screaming, "Press, I'm pressed," hoping that that would protect me. Protesters came and took me by the arm. I recall someone saying they were taking me to the medics. I followed them blindly and let somebody bandage my eye. I did not realize how badly I had been hurt because head wounds bleed freely. So I didn't panic. I thought I might just need a few stitches. Someone put me into their van and drove me to the hospital. Doctors told me I was going into surgery immediately to try to save my eye. I tweeted a photo of my face and a picture of my backpack, which I noticed had been hit with a bright green tracker round because I wanted friends and family to know that I was getting medical care in case someone had seen me on a live stream. I reported it duly and told the world I would be offline for a while because it is a bad idea to tweet when you are under sedation. I woke up the next day in the hospital. I remember doctors coming to tell me that I had lost sight in my left eye. I remember that all I wanted was a whiskey and a steak, or at least like a really artery clogging cheeseburger, but instead I was given extra bananas for the potassium. I called my husband and asked him to fly to Minneapolis to drive me home. He is a veteran who served with the Marine Corps in Fallujah. He is now my nurse, and I joke with him that I've taken more combat injuries than he has. For the first week, I was not allowed to take a shower, and let me tell you, trying to wash tear gas and dried blood out of your own hair in a bathtub without getting water in your face is tough. I smelled of gas and smoke and sharp copper for a week. I could not get the stink off me. I do not know what the rest of my life will be like. I do not know if I'll ever be able to cover protests again, or if my injury will make this work that I've engaged in since 2014 too risky. But I will write, and I will report, and I will try to do my job as competently as I always have. I am angry, of course, and I am grieving, and I am worried that the United States is becoming a more dangerous place to be a journalist. I have lost an eye, but not any moral clarity. I was shot in the face for being a reporter.
You were listening to Linda Toronto, a freelance reporter who was targeted by police violence, speaking before the House Committee on Oversight and Reform. Africa Today is a weekly news program providing information and analysis about Africa and the African diaspora, hosted by Walter Turner. Turner interviewed Horace Campbell, an international peace and justice scholar, and professor of African American Studies and Political Science at Syracuse University in Syracuse, New York. They discussed the Black Lives Matter movement and some of the more external economic factors influencing the current moment.
How do you discuss this moment, Horace, in terms of what people refer to as the Black radical tradition or the decade-long struggle for self-determination and independence for African people? This particular moment where you have the confluence of a number of different items, the pandemic, the economic crisis, the presidents that we currently have in the United States, and this outrage, this righteous rage around police brutality and abuse of communities and individuals and George Floyd, a number of other things. What is this moment, Horace?
Well, this moment is bringing clear to the entire U.S. population the nature of U.S. capitalism and the militarization of the U.S. state, the militarization of the global economy, and the manifestations of this militarization of the global economy in the communities of black people, brown people, immigrant people. In other words, many citizens of the United States do not understand the relationship between the dollar as a currency of world trade, dominance of Wall Street and the technological companies, and the U.S. military. And the fact that the U.S. military is allocated nearly $1 trillion by the military and the police forces for the United States to deploy military forces around the world to maintain white supremacy and international capitalism that is linked up with white supremacy. Now, what is the outflow of this in relationship to black people in the United States of America? Is that of that $1 trillion, on the National Defense Authorization Act, Section 1033, the pass off surplus equipment to the police force from the military, so tanks, pepper spray, and other military equipment, they are passed on to the community. So what the police is doing in the black communities is to ensure that resources go towards
social control towards repression, supporting white racism in the absence of food, healthcare, education, housing, environmental protection. So what has happened is that the appearance of the COVID-19 pandemic has merged with the pandemic of white racism. You have these two pandemics unleashing a capitalist crisis. This capitalist crisis has meant that the financial management that is going on in this country has been brought to the fore. So the government has poured $10 trillion into the hands of the Wall Street speculators. And yet, in 2008, when the United States was able to manage the financial crisis by pouring billions, trillions of dollars to the banking and financial sector, in the period of the COVID pandemic and white racist pandemic, we have the convergence of financial crisis, but the crisis of the real economy. 49 million persons unemployed, the majority black and brown people. So you have pandemic, economic crisis, financial crisis, housing crisis, environmental crisis. And in the midst of these social conditions, the police are there to repress the African population in the United States of America. Now, the African population in the United States of America have resisted this repression. This resistance has been going on ever since black people have been in the United States. But since 2014, since Mike Brown, Eric Garner, Trayvon Martin, there is a new movement that has arisen. And that movement has been internationalist in its outlook. This movement is called the Black Lives Matter movement. This movement has been very clear that when they talk about black lives, they're talking about the integrity and the dignity of the human being. And so this movement is not only international, but this movement has brought all sectors of the population in the United States into a massive uprising that the President of the United States promised to declare the Insurrection Act of 1807. He brought out troops into the black community, and it split the military to the point that we had an unprecedented situation in the United States of America, where the chairperson of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States military apologized for marching by beside the president. This apology was a result of the fact that the military brass, they're afraid of the attitude and the position of the black military forces. There are 49% of the U.S. military is black and brown people. In the higher echelons of the military, 4.3% of the military is black and brown. That is the top officers. So in the midst of all this, they promoted a black man, a black general, to be the head of the Air Force. But that will not solve the problem of which side the black troops will take in the midst of this rebellion.
Why did the, as many would say, the public lynching of George Floyd become a point where not only African people came into the street, but allies came into the street, brown people came into the streets, white people came into the streets, people globally came into the street? Why did this frame such a tipping point, despite what had happened with Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and Sandra Bland and Oscar Grant? Why, Professor Campbell?
Well, the killing and the public lynching of George Floyd took place in the three-month period where 100,000 persons had died of the coronavirus. Of that 300,000 persons, the 60% of those persons were black and brown people. And so
even now as we speak, there's no public health response from the federal government to the coronavirus, when more than 2 million persons are suffering from this virus. And today, it's probably up to 120,000. So the black life that is snuffed out by the police graphically pointed out to people that this is the callous response of the federal government, local state government, and the city police to the quality of black lives. So in my view, it is the convergence of the unemployment, the health pandemic with hundreds of thousands of people dying, and the police brutality that brought the people to a point where they were able to merge all the history of popular uprising to bring the United States to a new political situation, so that the situation is one where all sections of the United States ruling elements are scrambling for answers of how to deal with the uprisings.
That was Horace Campbell being interviewed by Walter Turner. Keep listening. We'll be back after a short break. Davey D is the host of KPFA's Hard Knock Radio. He spoke with Ebony Ava Harper, the director of the transgender health equity organization California Transcends, based out of Sacramento, California, as well as Sean Seifel-Wall, an intersex activist based in Atlanta, Georgia, and a co-founder of the Intersex Justice Project. They spoke about the uneasy relationship between the LGBTQ community and African-American culture, and how that impacts the Black Lives Matter movement.
There's been a number of trans folks that have been killed. There's been outcry about this. We saw thousands of people line up for a rally in Brooklyn to talk about Trans Lives Matter. One would think with such large numbers that this should be a no-brainer. Yet and still, it's a big obstacle in many circles, especially within our own ranks as Black folks. So let's talk a little bit about this. And I want to start off with you, Ebony. How are you seeing things? What do you feel is being either overlooked or passed over when we talk about transphobia and when we talk about just trans people in general that exist within our community?
There's so many intersections that go with that. And we have to talk about the church, the Black church, and the Hoteperi and the Hebrew Israelites, and just the reason why things are overlooked in the Black community. We'd have to start there. And you know, some people feel that my existence is a sin. Some people feel that we're unnatural. We're not supposed to be here. So you have a divide. Even in BLM, you have a divide where people are actually more progressive in the Black community than we've ever seen. And then you have the religious folks, the closed-minded folks, those type of folks. So on one end, you have tremendous progress. On the other, you have just closed-mindedness and ignorance.
Right.
And even we have backstepped a couple of steps because of this president as well, who promotes transphobia and homophobia. And so some of these people feel validated. Even if they was coming along, you know, this president kind of reinforced what they were thinking before.
Right.
There's definitely a divide. And right now in the trans community, you're seeing protests against the protests. You know, why aren't you including us? You know, so you're seeing pushback in our community because you don't hear about our murders in Black Lives Matter. Their excuse is, you know, they predominantly focus on Black people that have been murdered by police. But I would argue to say that in the BLM narrative, you don't really see a lot of women like promoted nationally. You don't hear of their stories nationally like you do men's stories. You don't hear trans stories like you hear cis men stories. You don't hear gender nonconforming stories. You know, we have so many intersections in the Black community. Our community is not a monolith.
Right.
Even when you get to the LGBT community, we don't all think the same. We have different ways we navigate life. We're just a microcosm of the Black community, and we just have different ways we express ourselves. But anyway,
let me ask you this, and then I'll bring in Cypha. You said a few things. One, let's talk about the notion that trans people are somehow folks who don't deserve to be here because they're sin, or there's some cultural aspect that we bring up. You know, you often hear people say there was none of that in Africa, so why is it there now, right? Is that a cover up for something? And let me frame it this way. I often hear people use the religious angle, not all churches, but a lot of them, right? A good many that will point this out. But there's a lot of sins, if we're saying homosexuality and trans folks are sinners or sinful, there's a lot of things that go on in the church that we could point to that sin. I see people at clubs. I see people cohabitating together. I see a lot of things that if we pulled out the book and said, here are the tenets, we've all, you know, have transgressed. So why is it the focus on this transgression versus all others? You know, when I was living with my wife before we were married, it was nobody picketing and saying, you're a sinner. It was just like, you're doing what you're doing. So why that? Then we also have folks that say, well, it never existed in Africa, but it exists now. So if we're here in 2020, we're not in Africa 1300, 1400 or whatever. So what's the point? You know, there's a lot of things that didn't exist. We weren't drinking 40s. You know, we weren't being killed by police. You know, there's a lot of things that weren't going on that we may want to get rid of. And there's a lot of things that were going on that we have yet to practice. You know, for example, our spirituality coming out of Africa, right? So we can go down that road if we're talking about trying to keep it 100. But the point that I'm getting at, it seems like these things that people pop up seem to be an excuse, a convenient excuse to not accept somebody like you, Ebony. So what do you feel it is really driving this?
What do I feel that's driving this? It's the same thing. It's so many things. But we'll start from the African thing that we didn't exist in Africa. And we did exist. I am a spiritual person, and I believe that energy never dies. And so there was a trans person, had to be a trans person, LGBT people in Africa, because I was born like this. This wasn't a choice. I didn't choose to be trans. It's just the way the universe chose to express itself through me. And so I think it's human nature also to kind of make yourself more better than someone or higher above someone. So there's that factor. There's the factor of there's a clear difference in how we are, and we challenge people, and people don't like to feel uncomfortable just in presentation, in relationship. And so those are some factors. But I'm interested in hearing Cypher's input.
Cypher, we're ready to hear from you. What would you add to this conversation?
I think about this a lot because as someone who is intersex of trans experience, I think, if I can step back and take a full view of Black people, I mean, that's why I moved. I used to live in the Bay, now I live in Atlanta. And I moved to Atlanta because I wanted to be around Black people all the time, right? Mm-hmm. To witness different aspects of Black life. And I think one thing that we're contending with is this, like, we have this historical trigger around lynching that has never been resolved, right? And I think there's something like a panic that happens to Black people whenever a Black man is executed by the state, right? And it's something that is very specific to Black men because we don't go up for, like, we don't destroy property. We don't, have big rallies and protests when, like, Black women are killed, Black trans women are killed, and even when Black children are killed. Right. And I think even like historically, we always reference the sort of murder of like Black men. And it's not to say that Black men aren't killed by the state. It's not to say that Black men haven't been lynched. But I think we also need to recognize that Black women have also been lynched, and Black women have been subjected to atrocities that aren't documented in the same way as the murder of Black men, you know? And I think there's something to get even a little bit more theoretical. Is this like Black people love patriarchy? Black people love patriarchy, right? And I think we live and die by patriarchy. We really uphold Black men at the expense of Black women and Black children. And we've done that many times. I've seen it in my family. I've seen it in my community. And there isn't the same, at least in the United States, there isn't the same level of violence toward like trans men, studs, as there is toward Black trans women, right? Because they're like, oh, okay, this woman, quote, wants to be a man. Who doesn't want to be a man, right? But if there's a Black, and I'm not going to go down that road, but for Black trans women who like reject Black masculinity, the cost is death. And we have seen it time and time again that Black women are being killed mostly by Black men. And I think that's something uncomfortable. That's something we don't want to look at, but that's something we have to face. That's something really ugly that we have to acknowledge.
Yeah, and I would add to that, that these men are attracted to us too.
Facts.
And so
Facts.
They feel like, it's against who they are. They shouldn't be attracted to us because that's another man. And so they knock us off because of that.
You are listening to Ebony Ava Harper with Sean Cypher Wall, speaking to Hard Knock Radio's Davey D. This concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates that contributed to the production of this show. I'm Scott Baba. Thanks for listening.
This has been COVID Race and Democracy, a daily broadcast by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates. Produced by a group of committed men and women volunteers willing to make a difference. If you tuned in late, you can listen and download the show from our YouTube channel, Pacifica Foundation TV, or from the website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
tell a friend about it. It will be worth it.